I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Today in Madison, Nature's Social Union, the study of the human-animal connection. It's a public lecture, which will take place tonight. You'll have time to attend an art exhibit and a workshop to benefit WisCares, Wisconsin Companion Animal Resources Education and Social Services. This is a wonderful partnership at the University of Wisconsin, and they work to protect the human-animal bond within vulnerable populations. They provide basic veterinary medical care, housing support, and advocacy and other support services to Dane County pet owners who are homeless or at risk of homelessness, as well as those who are unable to pay for veterinary medical services needed for access to housing. They brought in some wonderful speakers, and there's a public display of art and beautiful pictures, moving pictures of people who are homeless and their pets with such joy on both faces, actually, the pets and the people who are homeless. There's going to be a public lecture tonight by the executive director of the Institute for the Human-Animal Connection at the Graduate School of Social Work at the University of Denver. And also this exhibit done by the training coordinator at the Silberman School of Social Work and a research writer for the National Museum of Animals and Society. She is focused on the Skid Row neighborhood of downtown L.A. and has taken pictures of homeless people who have pets, and a surprisingly large number of people do. We're going to have three guests with us, and we're going to start with Abby Steinbeck. And Abby is a social worker at the WisCares program, this outreach partnership, and she will give us an outline of all that they are doing and what today's conference and lecture is all about. Abby, hello. Thank you so much for being with us.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you. So tell me a little bit about WisCares. It's really a wonderful organization. Your vision is a Dane County where all pets and all families have equal and consistent access to veterinary medical care, social support, and human health services. How do you accomplish that?
Well, that's a fabulous question. I think we start by approaching the services that we provide in a manner that views the pet and the owners as a family unit, and in honoring kind of a housing first approach to serving our those who utilize our services as well. So really coming at what we're doing from a perspective of really honoring that human-animal bond, as well as honoring some base understanding that access to basic needs and housing is a really important thing as well.
Mm-hmm. So you're preparing. There are a lot of places that won't take pets. I'm sure that you have to lay some groundwork to let people know how important that bond is. And for people who are making the transition from being homeless to housing first, the pet has to come along.
So, yeah, I think you're right in that there is a lot of groundwork that still needs to be laid. And one of the services that we provide is boarding. So in the meantime, while we're working on building that groundwork with a lot of social service agencies as well as housing service providers, providing a safe place for animals to stay while their owners, while their human family is taken care of, some of the basic needs, accessing shelter and accessing medical needs, etc. So you're right, there's absolutely a lot of groundwork that needs to be laid that we're working on, and in the meantime we have some boarding services available as well.
Oh, you do?
We do, yes. So it's not super long term, but it is available to folks to access while they are needing to access other kind of human services such as medical needs or shelters to be able to get back to accessing some of those housing as well.
Mm-hmm. And tell me about today's conference, all that's involved, the people who are attending this conference.
Yeah, so we just had our morning workshop, which was fabulous, with Dr. Tedeschi, and we talked a lot about the human-animal bond, we listened a lot about that, as well as learning kind of how we're all connected and how that all plays into the well-being of humans, animals, and our environments. So that was the morning. We also have a fabulous art show that's on display right now at the Pyle Center at UW that Christine will share a lot more about as well, that is called My Dog is My Home, and really showing that human-animal bond with folks who are experiencing homelessness. And then we have an evening presentation as well that is open to the public and free if folks are interested in that.
Mm-hmm. Great. Stay with us because we'll talk more about the people who have come through your doors as we carry on. Two of the people who are involved in the public lecture and this morning's activities and the art show are with us now as well to talk about this human-animal bond. Dr. Philip Tedeschi is a professor and executive director of the Institute for Human-Animal Connection at the University of Denver, and he is internationally known for the work that he's doing on this interaction with a focus on the therapeutic potential of animals in human health, the ethics of human-animal interaction and public safety and public health. He was one of the keynote speakers this morning, and he's going to be giving a public lecture on this tonight, and I believe that will be at 6 o'clock. Philip, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thanks for having me.
Isn't it good we have animals in the world? And we can really connect with so many of them, and they're so darned important to us.
That's for sure. It sounds like you might have animals. I can tell by the tone in your voice.
I do. I do. And the work that you're doing on the human-animal interaction, it's a whole field that is exploding right now, isn't it? We used to discount. We're at the top of the chain here, and all of a sudden, we're realizing how rich this whole area is and how much animals have to teach us.
Yeah, they really do. And I think you're right. This issue has become prominent to a large degree, I think, because people are recognizing that it's not just the human animal that creates quality of life and, you know, makes our world special, but really it's all life around us, and we should be interested in it. And when we do get interested in it, really, in many regards, the quality of our lives are improved by having healthy animals and healthy ecological systems around us as well.
Mm-hmm. I was interested that you've done a lot of work with Outward Bound, which I've heard is a transforming experience for many people who attend this, probably partially because the participants are having interaction with animals in a way they never have before.
Well, Outward Bound, you know, was formative for me in part because what Outward Bound does is it encourages people to get outside and to have experiences. And, you know, that's one of the ways animals are involved in clinical work, is that it would be considered a version of or a type of experiential intervention or practice, and can be tremendously effective because somebody is, in the case of animals, having real relationships. And so, you know, when many of the circumstances and clinical issues that we work on with people, the origins of the challenge, in some cases, things like trauma, where they've been hurt by somebody or hurt by a human being, animals are fantastic because, you know, if that person doesn't trust a human being, in many cases, they can begin building a relationship through a non-human animal.
Mm. And tell me how you do just that in the work that you do.
Well, animals are now involved in virtually every clinical setting, all the way across the human lifespan,
wow,
from working with early childhood development and education and clinical work, all the way through adolescence, adult mental health, as well as end-of-life issues, even right to the last hours that somebody is alive. Sometimes the persons or the relationships they want to have with them at the end of life are not human relationships, but non-human relationships. So I think the you know, one way to think about it, I'll give you an example, would be the first responders now to tremendously challenging events like school shootings, mm-hmm, like in Newtown, Connecticut, are often the presence of safe animals. So those communities are so terrorized and so uncertain about contact with human beings after an event like that, almost a, you know, sense that evil has descended on their communities. They're still looking for connection and reassurance that there are real relationships out there. But in many cases, that happens through something like a safe therapy dog. And so, you know, for example, some of our work involved, you know, working towards helping individuals, you know, just get back to school, just get back to normal. And in many cases, that is done through their connection, let's say, with a well-trained and trusting therapy dog.
Mm. And why is that? Because you can talk in private to that animal, because that animal just kind of looks at you and you feel a tenderness?
Well, that could be part of it. The research that we have done does demonstrate that people do use their animals as confidants and do talk to them, you know, in ways that are considered private. But probably in the circumstance I just described, and really the first step of trauma recovery is getting control of your own physiology. So when somebody's been through a really traumatic event, and this is also true for our service members who have experienced combat trauma and things like that, mm-hmm. is that their mind has really been trained to respond, you know, to that particular traumatic experience. In the case of, you know, persons who have had, let's say, involved in a trauma like a school shooting, many cases they have to learn to live really in their own body again, get control of their physiology, be able to self-regulate heart rate, breathing, you know, those sorts of things. And the resting heart rate, let's say, of a therapy dog is just below that of a person, and can be used much like a biofeedback tool just to get control of those physiological components. And that's the first step of trauma recovery work.
Oh, meaning what? You just sort of put your hands on the animal's heart or what?
Well, you can do it in a bunch of different ways. Some therapists have been known to even do things like carry a stethoscope so that the child could
really
listen to the heart and respiration of the animal. But you can also do that by having the animal just lay next to them or even lay across them and get very quiet, and you're beginning to listen to the nice, you know, even beat and breathing of a relaxed animal. And the origins of that mechanism for really, you know, recovering from trauma is an old and familiar one that that all animals use. So the way most animals will determine that they're in a safe environment is by taking in information from the other living animals in their environment to determine that, in fact, that they're safe. And so a resting animal for a person whose system has been, you know, dysregulated by that trauma is able to recalibrate. We actually call it coherence, which would be to get their own physiological system, you know, paired with what we would now know is a safe setting for them to actually begin to feel safe. That changes the brain chemistry of that individual, and can begin to start to heal.
Mm, that's fascinating. And are there enough places in the country to do that kind of work with the animals so they're ready to take on this task?
Well, yes and no. We've had a long history of this work being done through volunteer organizations, groups like Pet Partners and many others that are available across the United States. But increasingly in the work that I do at the University of Denver is beginning to train professionals to incorporate animals in the work that they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Also joining our conversation, we'll be back to everybody in a moment, is Christine Kim. Christine is a research writer for the National Museum of Animals and Society, has been involved in social work with the homeless for a number of years now, and she focuses on Skid Row neighborhood of downtown Los Angeles. She has done some very moving portraits and poetry, really, of the estimated 10% to 25% of the homeless who have animals, and there are only a handful of shelters in the country designed to take in interspecies families. Her project is, I love the name, My Dog Is My Home, The Experience of Human-Animal Homelessness. It's a multimedia online and offline exhibit that you can see at, I believe, at the Pyle Center. Christine, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
Yeah,
Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you here. I've seen some of the pictures. I haven't seen the actual display, but the pictures are so tender, and on the faces of so many, you can just see this bond between the homeless and their animals, and also this incredible joy on the faces of many people who don't have much, but boy, have they got that bond.
Yes, definitely. When you take a look at the eyes in the photograph, you can definitely see the depth of that bond. But also, I think what you miss in seeing the photographs when you're not at the actual physical exhibit is the audio piece and the video piece. So the exhibit at its core is actually a collection of stories about the experience of human-animal homelessness. And So I would encourage people to come out and experience that element of it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you have worked with homeless Skid Row neighborhood of downtown L.A. Tell us some of the stories.
Sure. Oh, my gosh. There's so many.
I bet.
Yeah, yeah. I just want to set the context a little bit.
Sure.
If people have never been to Skid Row in downtown L.A., it's really kind of a shocking environment. I would compare it to setting foot in something like a refugee camp.
Mm-hmm.
You just see tents upon tents and sleeping bags laid out on the sidewalks for blocks. I believe Skid Row is 52 square blocks of downtown
Wow.
LA, which is a huge area.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very tremendous when you compare Skid Row to what's directly around it. So downtown LA has seen just a huge amount of development. And on one side, you have lots of financial institutions and fancy restaurants and coffee shops. And on the other side, you have what's called the Arts District. So fancy lofts and galleries. And then dividing those two parts of downtown, you see this strip of Skid Row. And it's really just quite the juxtaposition. But the exhibit was really inspired by my work as a social worker on Skid Row. So I was working in a housing program, and I got to witness firsthand the struggle of people who were coming into the housing program with their animals. And so the housing program, just like most programs that serve the homeless, has a no pets allowed rule.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was this one particular person that I was working with early on that really... You know, I'll never forget them. I'll never forget them because they changed the way that I look at the issue. They really inspired me to continue this work to this day. But he moved into his housing program afraid of exposing the fact that he had a dog with him. So he snuck his dog in to the housing program, and he would take it out for walks by hiding it in his backpack until he got outside. But, you know, eventually property management found out, and there was this this terrible ultimatum that they gave him. And they said, you can either get rid of your dog and stay in housing, or you can get out and stay with your dog. And that's not an ultimatum that anyone should ever have to face.
Right. So what was the outcome?
Well, lucky for him, I was his case manager, and I'm a big animal person, so I did everything in my power to advocate for him, and eventually we got emotional support animal status for his dog, and by doing that, the property manager had no choice but to make a reasonable accommodation for this man's dog. So it's something akin to a service animal. It's not exactly the same thing, but they have some protections under the Fair Housing Act. And so, you know, the landlord really had to look the other way. Look the other way with the
dog. And how do you get emotional support? Do you have to go to a court to do that?
No, not exactly. You have to get the most important thing you have to do to establish emotional support animal status is get a letter from a mental health professional. And the letter has to state very specific things in it. And you can actually find an example of a letter in case, like, even your mental health professional doesn't know what it's supposed to look like. You can just print it out and take it to them and say, like, these are the things that need to be in it. And you can find an example of it. And, in a really special toolkit that was put together called the Helping People and Pets in Crisis Toolkit. But the letter has to state the mental health professional's license number. It has to state this person has a disability and that the animal is necessary for them to have full use and enjoyment of the dwelling.
Mm.
And that having the animal on site is connected to their disability.
Mm-hmm. And Abby, are you using that in Madison?
That's a great question. I think it's the complexities of having an animal as an emotional support animal in that status can sometimes it can create difficulties in terms of when it's appropriate and when it's not appropriate to go that route. And I think there's also some complexities around enforcement and being able to access a mental health professional who really understands all of that is also something that can be difficult. So it is definitely something that we are navigating as well with WISCares, and something we're really working on, trying to create some kind of take the lead in the community on creating some guidelines around that as well. Mm.
And Philip, what are you doing in your work at the University of Denver, and what do you know about what's going on in the country to let the mental health community and doctors as a whole know about how important this bond is and how the field is developing?
Well, it's definitely an exciting time in this field, in part because the evidence that, you know, we've known for virtually forever that animals are important to people, but in many cases those were, you know, experienced through individual stories and anecdote, and now we start to have, you know, quite a lot of supportive evidence that these ideas are in fact legitimized and evidentiary. And so what we're starting to do is we're starting to train professionals that are beginning to build these evidence-based practices into their work. So at our work at the University of Denver, we're training professional social workers who can now specialize in this area. We're also starting to train psychologists and special educators and others in this very same way. That's really changing a lot, and partially because the field, the helping professions and the allied social sciences can begin to become allies in these circumstances that you just described. And so we want to avoid, you know, fraudulent and, you know, unfortunate kind of versions that either put people or in many cases the animals in at risk. But when we do this through the lens of good practice, really best practices, the ethical care of both human beings and animals, we not only can become much more supportive of these, but we can also become more accurate and have good outcomes.
We're going to pause for a moment and we'll return and start taking phone calls for our guests. We have three guests, and we're talking about this wonderful conference that part of took place today. There's an exhibit that will go on all day long and a public lecture tonight, Nature's Social Union, the Study of the Human-Animal Connection. It's a public lecture, art exhibit, and workshop. It will benefit WISCares, Wisconsin Companion Animal Resources, Education, and Social Services. It's a partnership at the University of Wisconsin, protecting the animal-human bond within vulnerable populations. They do some wonderful work, basic veterinary medical care, housing support, advocacy services to pet owners who live in Dane County who are homeless or who are at the risk of homelessness. The exhibit, the art exhibit, is of homeless people in Skid Row, Los Angeles, who have pets, and some very moving, I've seen the pictures, but there also are videos and sound. It's many, many stories. Our guest worked with that population for quite some time, and also a professor and executive director of the Institute for Human-Animal Connection, who has done research, scholarship, training, and practice focused on human-animal interaction with a focus on the therapeutic potential of animals in human health, the ethics of human-animal interaction, as well as public safety and public health risk associated with cruelty. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show, or on Twitter, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number, and we go to Diane in Waukesha. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I've got a question. I know that the programs that they're talking about certainly sound really beneficial for the individual. However, my concern is sometimes, and not only even in the housing realm, but it's my understanding that this whole issue of companion animals oftentimes, the animal, there's no process to vet the animal as far as its appropriateness to be around others, et cetera, children and all that type of thing, where you may have a bond that's really helpful and significant between an individual with a disability and a specific animal, but even outside of the housing realm or inside the housing realm, depending upon the circumstance, that animal may not necessarily be appropriate or under control, or you know what I mean?
Yeah. Professor Tedeschi, let's give it to you.
Sure. That's a great question and an important one, because you're absolutely right. There are a lot of circumstances where there really isn't, you know, careful thought of and vetting of the animal. In a lot of cases, too, when we see, you know, animals that, for example, are unpredictable or maybe even unsafe, those are usually animals that in many ways are not very happy or are quite stressed themselves. And that would reflect, in most cases, you know, an unfortunate lack of awareness of the other part of the human-animal bond. The definition of the human-animal bond, in fact, is a mutuality of that relationship. So it has to be beneficial to both. Now, I think what the question might be getting at in part is that the new policies related to pet prescription and emotional support animals are challenging, because our professionals are not highly trained in most cases to do that. Most mental health professionals, for example, are not animal behaviorists, and they don't really have that expertise, and they're not required to have that expertise based on the law. But I think with careful reading of the wording of the law, one of the things that we should be aware of is that we're not required to incorporate that animal if that animal poses a danger or a risk to other persons in that environment. In fact, that would be where the mental health professional should say, you know, really, I'm sorry, I can't do that prescription because it would not be beneficial. You know, keep in mind, it's not helpful, not therapeutic for human beings to be in the presence of a stressed out
Sure.
or angry or dangerous animal. That, in fact, contributes to their challenges. Now, you know, with homeless populations, I think that becomes, you know, part of the importance of programs like the WISCARES program, where they can get support of veterinary care, stability. The more health, you know, the healthier an animal is, the more predictable and safer and healthier they are. And so those things tend to improve when we provide support for those individuals. Mm.
Christine, what did you notice when you were working with homeless on Skid Row in L.A.? Were the animals gentle? Were they well-behaved? How did they deal with behavior issues?
They are so well-adjusted.
Really?
The animals are so well-adjusted, yes. And I think in part that, I mean, large part, that has to do with the fact that they're with their people 24/7. And I think Abby can attest to that, too. Yeah.
Abby?
Yeah, one of the things I was just going to mention is kind of that interdisciplinary teaming that's really valuable when you're referring and talking about human-animal bond and therapeutic implications, which is one thing that WISCARES really strives for, is that interdisciplinary connection with social service providers as well as veterinarians that can really address kind of what the caller was asking about, that behavior of the pet as well,
mm-hmm.
and the health and wellness of the pet and the animal.
Is there a side specialty now? I would imagine there are, and probably all of you could be in this category, there are mental health practitioners who are also animal behaviorists. Is that study in schools around the country? Is there a need for that?
Yeah, you know, it would be nice if that was the case, and there probably is going to increasingly be a need for that, and we grapple with it. How much, you know, animal behavior, for example, or animal training competencies would a mental health practitioner need to have to be able to do this work? We really don't have a perfect answer to that, more than less for sure, and more than they're getting now. But frankly, it's quite unique still, unfortunately, for the allied social sciences to wrap their brain and their capabilities around the importance of the human-animal bond. And so I think that's one of the reasons this workshop is important, and also why the programs that are doing this work are beginning to become quite significant in terms of changing the dialogue in this area.
Right. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Cynthia Menominee. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi.
Hi.
I worked for 9 years before retirement in services for students with disabilities, and we did have students who were prescribed a care animal, cats mostly. We had a young woman with anxiety issues, and a part of her accommodations, we said, yes, she needs her dog in class with her. And I just read our senior highlights for August, and our Meals on Wheels just received $2,500 from Meals on Wheels America to support the client pet program. it helps them with food supplies and care for their pets. So we try to accommodate our students who are renting from us when they ask for a cat or a dog, because that means so much to them.
Right. Whoever wants to respond, go ahead.
One thing I just wanted to bring up is kind of the importance of supporting folks who may not be in the best situations with the food for their pets as well, like what the caller was mentioning. And that's one thing that WISCARES also tries to help with. One thing that we find is people who have companion animals will often feed them before themselves if they are in a tricky situation. And so that's kind of another basic need supportive service that we really focus on, is if you are in this situation and you're needing that help, we want you to be able to feed yourself as well. We can help you out with that. So I appreciated the caller bringing that up.
Mm-hmm. When you were in Los Angeles doing that work, what did you find when people, I'm sure there were times when there wasn't any money around and they had to feed both themselves and the pet. Were there places to eat? You gave scraps to dogs, or were there places like what exists in Madison, Christine?
There were a couple of programs that existed to distribute dog food, but there were certain criteria that you had to meet, so not everyone could benefit from them. But like Abby was saying, people often feed their dogs before they feed themselves, and so whatever change that they could kind of come up with would go towards feeding their animals.
Cynthia, thanks for your call. We go to Judy in Chilton. Hi, Judy.
Hi.
Hi.
I rescued a dog about a year and a half ago. And, he picked me. There were a whole bunch of people in the shelter, and he came up to me and sat on my lap and put his head on my neck. I'm not sure what he is. They said that he's Boston Wire Hair Terrier and Poodle. We call it designer dog gone awry because... He looks like a coyote and a raccoon. But the problem that we're having is, it took 6 months for him to even accept my husband. He didn't bite him or anything, but my husband would come home and he would do the submissive pee and go and hide.
Hmm.
But when I come home, he acts like a regular dog, and he does this around my whole family. He just will, if I'm gone, he'll sit in my chair and wait for me. And this has been going on for a year and a half, and I'm trying to get him to trust other people because everyone says he's such a great dog when I'm there. But he just doesn't have that trust. I don't know what it is. It's just that one person bond.
Yeah, Philip.
Well, I think a lot of people have similar stories. You know, we've all seen the bumper sticker, you know, who rescued who, is the old adage. But I think one of the things that's very interesting that you're bringing up is this idea that we refer to as epigenetics. It's this idea that our lives' journeys are informed by the experiences and the environment, all of the information that shapes us. And that's true for people. In fact, the science behind epigenetics, for example, is exactly what allow us to begin identifying, you know, the direction for, let's say, positive youth development, or, for that matter, risk factors that implicate, you know, what causes things to go badly for children, what puts children at risk. The same thing is true for other animals, that as we start to understand health benefits or risk factors for all sentient beings, one of the things that it really brings us face-to-face with is what the lives of other sentient participants on the planet are experiencing. And in many cases, the dogs that we find in sheltering environments are impacted by problematic experiences. They're not all necessarily physically abused or something like that, but in many cases we've had animals that have had, you know, problematic parts to their own development. So when we meet them and they're trying to integrate themselves into our complicated lives, a lot of times we'll see them having opinions about, you know, people they're more comfortable with, circumstances that they enjoy or don't enjoy. And that it's one of the wonders, really the wonderful things even, about having those animals in our lives, is it causes us to be more empathic for others, starts us to become considerate, to their needs. And it also makes us overall more empathic human beings to what does it mean to welcome another into our lives or into our homes. It's not always easy. Lots of people have very complicated and unique relationships with their animals, but it is a relationship, and in a lot of cases that becomes the very content that ultimately becomes part of our connection and bond with one another.
Mm-hmm. And I would imagine you talked about this being with a pet 24 hours a day, that bond is pretty strong. Are there concerns when shelter is made available for an emergency basis, if it's freezing cold out or way too hot and shelters are open and some may take dogs? Are there concerns because they're one-person dogs, Christine, or are these animals used to just being on the street and so they're used to all kinds of other stimuli, other dogs, other people?
That's a good question. The shelters that I'm familiar with that take animals actually have a separate kenneling system.
I see.
Right, and I know that's not an option in every city. Like, for example, in New York, that's almost impossible because of the space limitations. But in L.A., there's a fair amount of space to do something like that. And so one shelter that I have in mind is Path Hollywood, and they have a kennel system that they built in the parking lot. And so the animals are actually kept separately, and that eliminates a lot of the kind of problems that can arise from having animals on site, and maybe other people who don't appreciate having animals or maybe have like allergies. And so that's one way to go about it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much, Judy, for your call. Let's go to Jeff in Grand Marsh. Hi.
Good afternoon. I have had rental property in the past, and about the first 3 years, I allowed people to have their pets. And without exception, 100% of the time, I was disappointed. When they left, I was left with ripped screens, scratched walls, doors scratched, carpets tore up. So I'm wondering if you have kept track of this and how many of the homeless with their pets are destroying the property that they rent, and then who pays for it?
All right, who wants to take it? Abby, you want to start?
Well, I have to say I'm fairly new to WISCARES. I've been in Madison for a little while, but fairly new to WISCARES, so I haven't kept data or anything on that. I think the caller is bringing up a legitimate concern, though, in making sure that the animals that are with their humans and together as a family can all coexist with everybody else who's living in that area as well. So no, I haven't kept data or come up with a fabulous solution on who to bill for those issues. But I hear what the caller is saying.
Mm-hmm. Our other guests? Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, I'm sorry to hear that's been your experience. I don't think it's everybody's experience, but I do think that, one of the things that the question is getting at is some awareness around the fact that we still lack a lot of information about how to live with dogs, for example, and other animals as well. But let's just pick on dogs for a moment. Because in a lot of cases, what we're seeing is that dogs have been evolving alongside people for, arguably anywhere from, 10,000 to 70,000 years, that they're very connected with people. Mm-hmm. And so a very common problem for a lot of dogs is they don't like to be left alone. Mm-hmm. And they don't know how to be left alone. And then we don't have, good solutions to equip them with those. But we do a lot of things, for example, that we don't teach people about with dogs. Another one is interacting with dogs. We don't teach, let's say, young children, much like we would say, look both ways when you cross the street. We don't teach them about interacting safely with dogs. So we see, tens of thousands of dog bites every year because children are not being informed that this is an actual sentient participant. So these are not, TV screens or radios that are being brought into these homes. These are actual living, breathing participants. And so, you know, really what would be the most helpful would be, rather than blaming somebody for, let's say, those individual circumstances, to really look more broadly at the issue of what is it going to mean for us to have healthy relationships with animals.
Jeff, thanks so much for the call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Our number, 800-486-8655. There's a public lecture tonight at 6 o'clock that Philip will be presenting, art exhibit, which sounds wonderful, and workshop this morning that is benefiting WISC Cares, and it looks at this from a unique perspective. Obviously, it's applicable to everybody, but it looks at the human-animal connection and particularly looks at those who are homeless or those who are parts of Housing First programs but would like to move into places with their animals and need some help to have that happen. This whole connection of how the human-animal bond is so important to people who don't have very much. One of our guests has taken some beautiful pictures of homeless people with obviously important members of their family, their animals, particularly their dogs. Christine has. Christine Kim is a research writer for the National Museum of Animals and Society, and she has the My Dog is My Home, the Experience of Human-Animal Homelessness, which is part of this whole conference. Philip Tedeschi is a professor and executive director of the Institute for Human-Animal Connection at the University of Denver, and Abby Steinbeck is a social worker at the WISC Cares program. More phone calls momentarily here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go back to phone calls for our guests. Melanie in Swede Lake, hi.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I wanted to ask about your guests about empathy in animals. We've always had pets, multiple cats, usually one dog. And our cat, Stella, is so empathic. She will let me know if my blood rate, maybe by my voice, but my pulse is, if I'm on a phone conversation, very intense. In fact, she'll probably come out here now. I was sobbing last night. Something happened in my life, and so I was crying, and she was right there. And she always comes up, and she walks around me, and she'll keep crying until she gets my attention. And then when she gets my attention, then all of a sudden I'm like, oh, okay. And then I check myself, and I slow down. I talk quieter. And it's so interesting. I've never had an animal like her. When she's up and around the house, she wants to be by me. She communicates sometimes. She almost sounds like she's talking to me when she's upset about something. So I just was curious about, are some animals more empathic? Are those what you look for in rescue dogs? But just that whole thing is intriguing to me.
It is intriguing. Philip.
Oh, that's a lovely question. I couldn't have asked a better one myself. You know, let me put it this way. You know, I think in relation to cats, you know, they're amazing. They're very sensitive animals, incredibly aware of the environment around them. They can even get whisker fatigue, right, because their whiskers are so busy gathering information around them. And yet we euthanize, you know, millions of them in the United States that could be purposed for things like highly isolated persons and persons with, you know, profound and chronic loneliness. But animals do have, you know, complex cognitions and emotions much like people do. And individual animals are very different from one another. So we always want to be careful about, you know, making generalizations and saying, you know, Labrador retrievers are all good family dogs. Or, you know, cats, you hear a lot of people telling people that, you know, cats are, you know, are badly behaved or, you know, have their own opinions, those sorts of things. So we want to be careful about that because animals are individuals as well. But people have become, you know, to a large degree, lazy communicators compared to animals in a lot of ways. We use words, spoken and written. Animals are using everything but those to understand the persons that they live with. And so, you know, the very statement that's getting at this question, you know, is that a lot of people feel like the animals they live with know them better or are more responsive to their emotional needs in some cases than their human relationships, which is usually a feature of the fact that things like emotions are very relevant to families, to animals in their family systems. And so one of the things that they'll notice are changes in your physiology, your body posture, your voice tone, your emotionality. Those are all relevant information for animals. So they're in a lot of cases, to humans that they live with, feel as though they're very responsive to their needs.
Hmm. So did your cat come out, Melanie?
No, she's out laying in the sun right now.
Oh, she... My dog does that, too, every day. Just, you know, come on in, come on in. He just plops himself down and takes in vitamin D, I guess. I don't know, even if it's hot out.
Yeah.
So
well,
she's...
thank you so much.
Thank you.
That.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the story. Tony is next in Egg Harbor. Hi, Tony.
Hi, good afternoon. I don't know how you do it, Kathleen, but every subject I could relate to, and this one is probably the most... painful one I can relate to. On Saturday, we had to decide that Phoebe wasn't going to live.
Oh.
And we had, they're two sisters, Phoebe and Chloe, and in full honesty, I was really never into dogs, wasn't raised with dogs. My wife wanted to do it, and I said, okay. And 12 years later,
oh.
I was feeling a lot of pre-guilt of how I'm going to feel about losing one or two of the dogs, knowing that I was really just never into it too much. And then what the whole experience taught me was empathy for Chloe, her surviving sister, because they've been together, you know, every day for the last 12 years, and I can't imagine what that would be like.
Mm-hmm.
To have that loss. And in one day, Chloe sleeps in our bedroom. She goes with us everywhere we went yesterday and today.
Mm.
And I'm just totally committed to making sure that the balance of Chloe's life, that somehow I could replace, to a certain extent, how she lost her sister. And I was wondering if there's a relevance to that in people who are in uncertain life situations, that it gives them a chance to get outside of themselves a little bit and take care of something that depends on them.
Oh, I'm so glad you called, Tony. It's a lovely story as well. Christine and Philip, we have about a minute and a half left. Can I hear both of you respond? Christine?
Yeah, I often hear people who are homeless refer to their animals as their motivation to keep living. Because when they're faced with really difficult circumstances, their animal is the one that pulls them out of it. And they feel a responsibility to keep going because they have somebody to take care of.
Yeah, and I would say I've heard that a lot as well. And we actually have a number of populations that actually switching, you know, turning things over and not being the person being helped, but being the helper is a very critical part of their own recovery. So that's a very appropriate role for people to take, especially with an important member of your family that's in a time of need. So those become really relevant for a lot of people, especially groups that are not used to being given that opportunity or really need a responsibility or want, you know, that opportunity. And then I would say just the last thing, that end of life in many cases is one of the most beautiful points of the human-animal bond as well,
mm-hmm.
because it teaches us about our connection and the transitions and end of life considerations. And those are a big part of being human. And it's a important part of, part of our relationship with our animals, where we have to be selfless on their behalf.
Yes, yeah, we do. Tony, thank you so much. And well, that's the way to end, right? The end of life for some animals and people as well. Philip, you're speaking tonight, right? 6:00?
That's correct.
And where is that?
That is at the Pyle Center, right
okay.
on Langdon Street in Madison, Wisconsin.
All right. And Christine, your exhibit will be up through the day? Beyond?
Yes. Yes, it's open today until 9:00, and then tomorrow from 9 a.m. until 6.
All right, great. And Abby, if people want more information about WisCares, what do they do?
Yeah, they can check us out on Facebook, or they can go to our website, which is wiscares.wisc.edu. And we'd love to for people to check us out that way.
Okay. Thank you all so much for being with us and for all the work you do. Thanks.
Thank you.
Our guest, Philip Tedeschi, he's, again, speaking tonight at 6 o'clock. It's open to the public. Christine Kim and her exhibit, Homeless People of Skid Row, Neighborhood of Downtown Los Angeles, with their Beloved Pets, and Abby Steinbeck, social worker at the WISC Cares program. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing the program. Thanks to Kiri Salinas for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee, where we wanted to bring a dog today, but we didn't. So, oh, we'll do it another day. Any chance we get, we'll bring a doggy, and it always makes the work environment great, too. Thanks for listening.